Very good. So welcome everybody. And really it's lovely to have with us Joanne Offenstone, who's going to be talking about her new book, The Power and the Grace, which has just been published by Handspring. Those of you who don't know Joanne's work, she started GEMS, which is Joanne Offenstone's movement system, and been working initially as a physiotherapist. I think it was in Australia. 30 years ago or so.
Yes.
And
Moving away. Thanks, John.
many, many years ago. And is the author of other books as well and has worked extensively with people in Olympic teams and dancers. And we're going to talk a little bit about her work also with children and musicians too. So welcome, Joanne. Thank you for being here. It's really wonderful to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. So I know you work with sort of you were head of performance management for the British Olympic Association, I think, for a while, and you've also worked with the sort of Royal Yachting Association and the National Dance Company of Wales and the London Contemporary Dance School, and you're very involved, as I said, with children and music and avoiding them getting into bad habits and injury, which is a passion of mine as well. But I'm just wondering, how did you get into this originally, or your interest in this?
Well, that's a really good question, actually, John. I guess it began before I was a physiotherapist. So I had an interest in movement anyway. And then I was a coach. I was a volleyball coach, swimming coach, fitness coach, went into physiotherapy. And it started to find me because people started to ask me to come and watch them doing things, and I didn't really know why. And I've since reflected on that and realized that probably what happened was that nobody knew I couldn't see properly for the first 10 years of my life. I mean, I really couldn't see very much at all. So the only way I could recognize people was by the way they moved. And I guess that maybe something set some pathways there. And so I've kind of gone on this little journey. And I didn't set out to do anything specific, but as I always tell, younger clinicians coming into the field, do whatever you do with passion and do it to the best of your ability, and things will arise. And so I went from Australia to Hawaii, and I worked there for around 5 years. And that was a mixture of, road traffic accident victims and hula dancers and everything in between, which was wonderful. Came to Europe. And actually, I came and stayed to do a master's in philosophy of music, to be honest.
Oh, did you? Where
That's
was
what
that? Where were you doing
I
that?
did. Cardiff.
Oh,
So
Cardiff.
it was accidental. It was that time in life when I felt that a change was needed, and I packed my bags and sold everything and left Hawaii and arrived in Europe. Not really sure what was going to happen, but just very sure that something was going to happen. And so there we were. So I was actually working half time in the NHS as a physiotherapist, doing full time masters in philosophy of music. And while that was happening, then movement kept kind of arising. And the next thing I knew, Welsh Rugby was really interested in hearing some new ideas. And then that rolled on, and one thing's led to another. And yeah, here we are now. And my work probably spans very chronic complex patients at one end of the spectrum, because a lot of my clinical work is there, through to all of these winter and summer Olympic sports and the professional sports. But I think the thing is for me is that all of these are humans at different ends of the age range. I'm just as excited about falls prevention in the elderly as I am in child development, because it's all part of the human experience. And so I never called myself a sports physio because I'm a human physio. The dance company doesn't even think I am a physio because we really do kind of embodied coaching, and maybe it's an emotional or psychological, or maybe it's a physical thing, but how can you separate those things? It's just, how do we help somebody to express themselves more authentically and with greater, immediacy, and efficacy, whichever way we're going to go into that. So they often introduce me as the psychologist, because they can't really think of any way other way to express it. So here we are.
Yeah, I love the way that you talk about bringing all the psychology, the emotional, environmental, and things like fascia and brain science all together in one package, right?
Yeah.
Presumably that's what you teach through your GEMS system, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So GEMS is it's a philosophy of clinical embodiment as a teaching methodology, but it's also a framework that then supports all of these different elements and puts them into a system where you can actually integrate them effectively. Because one of the things I found with my teaching, I've been teaching a long time and teaching different kinds of people. So a lot of it has been teaching clinicians, but also people who are professional movement teachers, coaches, and they're all very passionate about what they do. And there's lots of research coming out, but it's not that easy necessarily to work out how do we marry together the mechanics and the fascia and the emotion and the psychology, and how do we bring all that together? And so GEMS is actually about creating a system that can actually hold that in a relatively straightforward way.
Lovely.
So yeah.
Cool. So should we, do you want to, I know you've got a little bit of a presentation, so do you want to, about your book, your new book? And just to say, we do have a discount code, which I'll put up at the end of this on Facebook and on Zoom as well. For people who want to buy it, I think we're getting 10% off and free shipping in the UK and the USA. So anyway,
okay, I know you've got do that. I can never do that bit. I'm just the worst salesperson in the world. So thank you for taking that responsibility from me.
Cool. So yeah, if you'd like to share your screen there, Joanne, that'd be fantastic.
Sure thing. There we are.
Beautiful. Beautiful cover. Handspring always do lovely, lovely books, don't they? Beautifully produced.
They absolutely do. And I searched long and hard to see if I could find an image, because I found this image that really expressed what I was trying to say. You know, that person, she's utterly centered within herself. She's completely grounded. She's expressing her emotion. She's actually embodying power and grace. And it's so interesting, because even if someone knew nothing about movement, I mean, we all instinctively can recognize someone who moves well. You know, we can feel it in our bones almost. When someone's able to, in this situation, you know, access their potential and then manifest it as intention, you know, and then with grace, what is grace? Well, it's taking that power and being able to deploy it under the conditions of choice and freedom. So, for example, you know, I'm sure that she can stand on one leg and do all sorts of things with that. For other people, standing on one leg is a massive challenge, and they don't have the conditions of choice or freedom. So it's quite interesting, because I believe that power and grace is accessible to us all. We see power in a dancer. We see grace in a shot putter. It's all about how we're able to access and deploy our intention, how to work with the forces that are acting on us, how to create them and how to control them. So it's an interesting place to be. And when I'm talking about ease and efficiency, something that I've seen a lot of, because many of my patients and clients have had a lot of intervention and they've been taught a lot of things. And often what I see is very cognitively controlled movement, lots of rules, but the sense of ease, the sense of uniqueness in them, in their movement, just isn't there. And so that's where I started with this book. And of course, the term functional movement is an interesting one too, because it means different things to different people. So I'm going to start from the premise that you can't use any one thing to actually create ease and efficiency in functional motion. We need many different things playing together. So this particular little schematic, it's a very simplified. We can make it as complicated as we like. You know, at the moment here, we don't have the conditions of context and environment, which are a part of the model that we explore in GEMS. But here, for example, if we're really honest with ourselves, often we are attached to one of these circles more than others. So some of us have a huge stock in strength. Others, it could be flexibility. Other people, it's control. And all of these things are marvelous, and they're all what I call potential building activities. So they create resources, but on their own, they don't turn into movement. So I usually say it's very much like learning a foreign language. When you learn lots of vocabulary and then you go to that country and you find that you can't put it in a sentence. Now, I did this in Argentina. I learned some Spanish. I was going to go and teach in Argentina, and I got there and I could have a conversation with a three-year-old. So I wasn't able to put it together. And I think with movement, we have a similar thing where sometimes we have expectations that our training will automatically turn into movement. And it isn't necessarily so, because we have lots of other elements that are involved. So for example, how we think about it, our beliefs, our understanding, our intentions, how we're processing the sensory information coming from the body, or if we look at this as kind of the distributed mind, really, if we look at how much information is coming up and informing us, our emotional context, which is extraordinary. And at the moment, you know, at this time in history for us, the effect on emotion, on how we're carrying ourselves through the world, is immense. So all of those things are rolled in along with all of this potential building. And then what we have is one of the most authentic forms of self-expression we can have. So that's kind of where we're starting with this, that we're not saying this is the one true answer. There's lots of things that are going to be rolled together. And I guess, you know, we have to start with the question, well, what is functional movement anyway? And if you get onto Instagram, you will get answers like, well, handstands and hanging from trees and all sorts of things like this. But, you know, functional movement is about what's relevant to you in your life. And I know a lot of people who have absolutely no intention of ever doing a handstand, but they have other functional needs. So we need to get away from functional movement being specific tasks, because actually underneath those tasks is a level of foundation. And that's what I really want to talk about today. And sometimes people say, well, can't we just get strong? And you might hear it's very fashionable. You can't go wrong getting strong. Strength's great, but it's still potential building. And I have actually, over the years, have had to work with lots of very strong people who don't move well. So to give you an example of a patient of mine this past year, he's in an occupation which is highly physically challenging, often very dangerous. He's had a year of low back pain. It hasn't been getting better, with leg symptoms as well. And looking at him, he looks so powerful. Squats, lunges, he can do those, no problem. But I asked him to take a deep breath. And what I saw was him completely disengage his upper body from his lower body. Just like, okay, this is where we need to start. We need to have a conversation about intra-abdominal pressure. Now, one of the big things about the book and about, well, what we teach in GEMS, it's all about the story. Brains, we're wired for stories. We're not so wired for facts. So for him, the story is one of your inner airbag. And the fact that when he draws a breath, that he keeps taking the lid off it. And so if we lose the inner airbag, then the muscles have to do something to actually help create some support for that back. So the first thing we need to do is actually establish that inner airbag. So you take this gentleman who's big and powerful and rough and tough, and you're thinking, we're going to do breathing. And for some people, they think, oh, I wouldn't dare. But if we tell him that story, that makes perfect sense. And when we looked at him doing a few little, one of the things he has to do is land from a jump, but no shock absorption. He's completely rigid. So we're talking about the fact that he's absolutely nailed his inner rhino. He's got the rhinoceros down pat, but we need the rhino and we need the panther. And so what we're going to do is we're going to work on that inner panther. He loved it. What he saw, when you talk to the brain this way, it starts to generate a whole lot of associations that have nothing to do with the big black cat. It will be generating visions of how that creature moves. And we can use that because it informs our own movement. Our brain is that clever. So he's already strong. He needs other balance in terms of how to move himself as a human being in an integrated way that's going to be able to go into a variety of different environments. From that, we could then lead into a discussion about stress and pressure and how he embodies that. He tends to go up and back, as many people do when they're under pressure. What happens then? We take the lid off our inner airbag. So now we're actually teaching him a story about his ongoing low back pain that actually seems fairly logical, quite acceptable for him because we've told it in stories. And actually that all went really well. You know, the low back pain was able to be resolved quite quickly by not just trying to strengthen him through it. Now, the other thing I hear a lot of, it doesn't matter how you move, just do lots of different kind of movement, which is great if you have some underpinning foundations. So the person who has functional variability is the healthy mover. The person who has lots of options, and lots of options they can put their hand on immediately, unconsciously. The person who doesn't move so well doesn't have that many options. However, often they need some building blocks, some foundations from which we can then work. So that's really what we want to talk about here. So if I start with the biomechanical, because you'll see I'll keep going back and forth. What is emotional? What is biomechanical? How does it affect the fascia? We're always in this continuous circular dance with a person. So let's talk forces. Now, forces, things like gravity, ground reaction force, these are our friends when we know how to use them. So we talk about something called functional force management. So these are these underpinning principles. So for example, if we look at this picture, a tennis player, we want to play a forehand. How do we create force? Where do we create it from? Well, sensibly, we create it from the most powerful part of the body, lower body. How do we do that? Well, he's going to move across the court. He's going to drop his center of gravity, which is going to help him to load those structures, store some elastic energy. He's then going to start straightening the legs, passing that force up through his legs to the pelvis. The pelvis will start to rotate, which will put a differential between the pelvis and the shoulders. What does it do? It creates a stretch from the upper to the lower body. We store elastic energy here because this is the power that's being transmitted from the feet all the way up through the torso and then funneled out through the arms. So we'd call that projection. So the ability to actually let a force out of the body. Now, if we don't know that, and let's say my patient comes to me with wrist pain, I've seen a lot of tennis players with wrist and elbow problems, and they get a lot of treatment to the wrist. The wrist in this scenario could be the victim. And if I look at them and I see that actually the legs are stiff, or they can't dissociate the upper body from the pelvis, so they cannot store this elastic energy, then I know that what we have is someone who is using power with the arm. And no matter how much weightlifting you do, you cannot develop the same amount of power just with your arm that you could if you'd actually pushed that force from your legs through your body like a whip. So this is one of the things that we start to look at, and we can apply this to any movement from a tennis forehand to being able to sit in a chair and get back out of it again. So these same principles apply at all levels. Now, this then connects into functional force management and then how that connects with fascia. So we're all very familiar with the whole concept of fascia. And then this has spawned fascial exercises. And then you've got lots of people rolling themselves. But I want to talk about something different. And that is how we have these myofascial relationships that are going across the body, through the body. And they're going to require movement to be able to access them. It's not going to work if we don't actually have the movement to create the elastic energy storage. So with our golfer, he's demonstrating what we call spiral elastic strategy. So this is where the body parts are heading in the same direction, but at slightly different timing. So as he takes the golf club away, the pelvis and the thorax are rotating in the same direction. The pelvis will stop and the thorax will keep going, which creates a stretch across the abdomen, all the way from the adductor on the other side. Then just as the shoulders get to the end of that movement, the pelvis starts to turn, which creates even more stretch. And that's where the power comes from. But if we don't have that rotational dissociation, then we can't access that myofascial system. So then we have to start pulling down with our left shoulder, for example. It's a super way to develop left posterior shoulder pain. Do we treat the shoulder? No, you can do a little bit, but it's not going to fix the problem. We can fix the problem if we're aware of our functional force management. Similarly, if I look at the runner, we're looking at diagonal elastic strategy. So here we have counter body rotation. So the thorax, the shoulders are going one way, the pelvis is going the other way, and they're alternating. So what do we see? We're going to see this myofascial relationship going all the way across the front of the body, all the way down the leg, and the diagonally across the back. What are we doing? As we rotate one way, we create a stretch, we store some elastic energy, it goes ping, we rotate the other way, creates a stretch. It's marvelously efficient unless you don't rotate. So one of the most common things I will see with people who have difficulties with both walking and running is a lack of rotation. And one of the quickest ways we can change their effectiveness and start getting their hips to extend and start getting them pushing off effectively is to restore that rotation. So we're starting to put together these various concepts. Now, let's take the runner for a minute. Now, with any rotation, we need an axis to rotate around. This is not just about bodies, this is any physical structure. If you want something to rotate, it must have an axis. So if, let's say, my runner is going out and they're a bit stressed, maybe they're one of these people who runs to burn off the adrenaline, and they've gone up and back, so putting their spine into extension, we now have a structure that is not easy to rotate around. If you think about what's happening to the joints there, they don't rotate well in extension. So that's going to change her ability to access these myofascial structures. And so she might come into your clinic or your studio or wherever you're working and say, I've got Achilles problems. And again, people get Achilles treatment and they do eccentric loading. And I'm not saying that that's not necessary, but it's not everything, because we haven't asked the most important question, which is, why is this structure under pressure? It's just too easy to blame it on overuse. And, you know, sometimes I have really bright patients who come and they say, well, if it's overuse, why do I only have it on one leg? Because the other leg has run exactly the same distance. I think that's a magically wonderful question. It's completely logical, isn't it? So instead, we don't just say, oh, it's overuse, let's just make it strong enough to cope. We're going to ask ourselves, well, why is it under pressure? And often, when we start to look more globally, we can start to see why this overpushing has been necessary. For those of you who are familiar with your mechanics, you'll know that if you rotate to the right, the weight will come into the left, yeah? Rotate to the left and the weight will come into the right. So, for example, many runners will rotate but only one way. So that means they're always putting more load on that left side. That left side has to push harder to propel you forward. So now we're starting to link lots of systems together. So that, if we can look at functional force management, let's take it down into the lower zone. Because there's so much mythology, and one of the reasons I wrote the book was to actually examine some of these beliefs, these rules of movement that people know that actually stop them from moving. So if I look here at what you might call a squat, I would be saying that's a demonstration of vertical force management. So the ability to drop and raise my center of gravity. Now, what have we got here? Well, we've got the hip extensors needing to move in a way so that they're contracting eccentrically, they're lengthening, and they're moving from inner range. Here we're in mid range, moving towards outer range, and then out of that again. What do we often see instead? Well, the first thing I see is people who cannot do this in balance because they believe a squat is a functional movement. Well, do you know what? When people come into my clinic, they actually need to do other things. They need to either be able to pick up their kids or run around on a football field. And they cannot do that with a bar on their shoulders. If I take the bar off, these people fall over backwards. And they'll quickly tell me that they could do that if they had a bar on their shoulders and it would be fine. We've got an artificial aid going on here. So when we talk about vertical force management, we're talking about the ability to be able to drop the center of gravity and raise it again in balance. That's one of these seed movements that I was talking about here. I'm not calling it a squat. It's going to happen at different levels. If I want to have shock absorption, I need vertical force management, but in a very small range of motion. If I need to land from a jump, I need vertical force management at varying depths, depending upon the height of the jump that I'm landing from. Then if we bring in some of the other factors, so let's have clarifying intention. So I'll see somebody and they're struggling to drop their center of gravity. And I'll say to them, well, which direction are you heading in? What's your intention here? And it's interesting how they're often not very clear about that. And I say, well, do you think you're going down? And they'll think, oh, yes, I'm going down. And you'll see the muscle tension. I'll say, do you know what? Gravity is your friend. I guarantee if you allow it to, gravity will take you there. But you've got the handbrakes on. And it's so interesting to watch somebody when they let gravity be their friend. It changes things. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's intention. Maybe it's they don't realize that they're going backwards. So they're ending up on their heels. And they often don't realize that they have a choice about that. Because, of course, you're not balanced on your heels. If you can't change direction and have choices if you can only be in your heels. So I might hold their hands and draw them onto their feet. And they go down even further. Because every time they go into their heels, their ankles have to tighten up to stop them falling over backwards. And they tell me I have tight ankles and that's why I can't squat. We bring them onto their whole foot and they go down further. And they think that's very strange. But actually, when you explain it, it's really quite simple logic. So we might have that situation. If I bring in the biomechanical, what's happening as we're squatting in a closed chain? Well, we have relative rotation, don't we, of the femur and the tibia. So we have external rotation of the femur, internal rotation relatively of the tibia. So if we're standing already in locked in external rotation, and so many people are, why are they? It could be that they're having force closure problems in the pelvis. So then that would mean that I would ask another question as to why that's happening. It might be because that strong sense of contraction feels very secure. I certainly know that if I'm under pressure, I can be standing doing some stir fry stirring and realize that my glutes are clenching like heck and I'm on the outsides of my feet. Like, what is going on with that? Well, this is how I'm embodying the pressure. And I become aware and then I relax and my feet come back on the floor again. And if I do that, it's much easier for me to go up and down. But if I'm stuck on the outsides of my feet, that's going to be really tough on the knees. And I see so many men, particularly with lateral knee pain from squatting, and they're already in external rotation and they cannot dissociate their lower leg from their upper leg. And so if that's the case, we don't have our normal biomechanics available and the body has to make other arrangements. So if I'm just looking at that vertical force management, you can see that we can start to pull from lots of different areas to find out, well, why is this difficult? I'm not just going to say to someone, we're going to give you the movement rules and you're going to practice till it gets better. Yeah. You see it with the lunge all the time. People come in and they tell me about their lunge. They've been doing lunges for 5 years. It hasn't got any better. Doing more of them is not the solution. So we learned about eccentric towards outer control in the glutes. What about propulsion? So now we're actually moving into inner range concentrically. Okay, totally different scenario. And as we propel ourselves forward, whether we're walking or we're running, again, this is an interesting story about intention. Many times I find that people are actually walking from behind themselves. So they're kind of sunk in the chest a bit. The feet are going out in front and they're pulling themselves over the ground. And that's a very different thing to actually becoming more buoyant and actually carrying yourself forward. And sometimes I say to people, do you want to go forward or backward? And they go, well, forward. Like, well, if you want to go forward, go forward. And it's so interesting to see the gait change. So again, I'm not going to dive into lots of inner range glute contractions. I'm not saying that they might not need it, but I am saying it's not going to actually take care of putting it into movement. You know, it's something that every single person who works in movement, either movement teaching or in rehabilitation treatment, you have patients who need the ability to accept weight through the single limb. We call that support in GEMS. And again, you know, if I look at this picture, all these pictures are in the book, and we're looking at, well, where is gravity falling on our hip? You know, such that the hip is centered and that those forces are actually shared. For that, I say it's like having an umbrella, and forces, gravity is kind of going over the umbrella. But if we're behind ourselves with the gravity, or we're in front, then we're going to change where gravity is falling on that hip. But why? Is it just proprioception? Is it just knowing where we are? Is it that our hips are responding to the rest of our body? So one thing you can have a little play with would be just seeing what it's like. And I'm just going to stand up for you here. And you can do the same thing with me. Put a hand on your greater trochanter and one on your sternum. And just see, where does the greater trochanter go when you shine your sternum towards the floor? You might find that it drifts forward. And where does it go if I shine my sternum up towards the ceiling? And it drifts back. So my sternum is actually directing what is happening with my hip in this situation. So, you know, you might be trying to do glute strengthening around here, when actually the most interesting and relevant part of the body is much further up. And why is it there? Well, our kind of somatic representations of being overwhelmed, for example, can put us here. It's not going to be unusual right now. One of the ways that people deal with stress is to go the other way. Sternum goes up. Every time that happens, it's affecting where the pelvis and the hips are. It affects your ability to connect your upper body to your lower body. It affects your ability for your abdominal wall to work at a nice low threshold rate that actually gives you that central control. So again, we draw in what is happening emotionally, with what is happening structurally, with what is happening functionally. And then simply, can someone sense themselves? Because the number of people that I work with where we put a hand on the chest and one on the belly, and we take a little step forward onto one foot, and either they leave their chest behind or they tip it forward, and they have no idea they're doing this. But when that happens, it's going to change our ability to accept weight. And so, and these are simple techniques to use to help someone to have that self-awareness. But the minute they carry themselves forward with their hands, one on top of the other, that's the moment that you go, oh, look, they've got core stability. Have I taught them about their abdominal muscles? No. But I have actually put them in a situation that would actually initiate that kind of response. Now, one of the things that is so important right now is understanding what part of the brain we're talking to. This was always important, but right now we're seeing people at such higher levels of stress than we have, you know, at such a bigger rate. I don't know about you, but I find that people are coming in and I look at their eyes over the top of their masks and almost see the whites of their eyes. So we need a little way to explain to them, and also for us to understand, that giving them lots of knowledge and lots of facts may be falling fallow, because if you've got a really active limbic system, then the prefrontal cortex becomes inhibited. So that's the part that could take on the facts and the knowledge and do something with it. But if you've got a lot of limbic stuff going on, lots of emotion, it's offline. And you probably know this yourself. You're thinking, where did my memory go? You know, do I have early onset dementia? What is going on with me here? No, this is just normal. So the way I like to explain things and the way I've wanted to do this in the book is to create stories that are easy for everybody to understand. So we can take the neuroscience, but it doesn't have to be complicated. She's like, if I want to unlock the prefrontal cortex, then I need to help someone to come to a calmer, more receptive state. I'm not going to bombard them with knowledge. And interestingly, as clinicians, if we're stressed to make us feel like we're doing a good job, often that's exactly what we do more of, because it helps us to feel like we're more in control and we're doing a good job and we're offering lots. But actually, it may not be actually what the patient needs themselves. So this is answering the question of which part of the brain are we talking to? We need to make our learning easy. So maybe we're going to spend some time settling somebody into their bodies, connecting with their body, doing simple things, simple tasks, just to reconnect with where I am, so that we can start to actually open up more of the learning circuitry. Other things to be aware of. Do we cue movement or do we cue anti-movement? It's really interesting. Everyone will go, oh, I cue movement. That's what I do. But if you've ever asked anybody to set something or brace something, for example, if you ask someone to draw the shoulder blades back and down and we're going to keep them there and lift the arm, I'm afraid you've just cued an anti-movement. You've just given the brain a go stop. It's not a go, it's a go stop. And you have to ask yourself, why would you draw your shoulder blades back and down to elevate your upper limb anyway? Because it needs to upwardly rotate that scapula to keep a nice healthy shoulder. So it's quite interesting sometimes, this is a reflective practice, to see, have I told someone to keep something still and then move something? Because you end up with a processing conflict for the brain. So is there a way that we can cue that actually removes that barrier? And then we have a go message, which means that all of the brain's resources can head in that direction. And then finally, on this note, it's learning to access brain associations so that you can bring your creativity, but also draw more out of the patient's brain. So it's so interesting, if you have a word, let's say honey, and you might think honey is something I put on my toast, and it might be sweet. And the brain's also logged its texture and its viscosity and the speed at which it moves, maybe the way the light shines through it. It's mapped all of it. And you can use that to actually influence somebody's movement, because the movement is completed by the brain before the body begins it. And that's the beauty of the predictive processing that is driven by our cerebellum. So if we're only looking at the movement and the body, often we've missed where the movement really began. And if you see a change in the eyes, the face, the breath, usually you can pick up that something needs to happen first. So just as a quick example, one of my patients was a young boy. He'd been in a very traumatic accident. He'd fractured his femur. He'd had it pinned. Once it had healed, the pins were removed, and then he refractured. And then a year down the track, I was contacted by his physiotherapist to say, I can't actually change his movement anymore. He doesn't get any better. And imagine the trauma, actually, that this young boy has actually encountered. And there are many stories I could tell, but one of them was about his ability to turn his body and to turn his body in the direction in which the accident had happened specifically. And he couldn't move. And his mum was sitting in front. And so I stood behind him and I had my hands on his shoulders. I said, tell me the yummiest thing you can think of. And he said, caramel buttons. I said, oh, I don't know what a caramel button is. Can you tell me about it? And he described his caramel button. I said, all right, what happens if you heat a caramel button? He said, oh, it goes all runny and gooey. I said, can you just like, can you see it? Can you taste it? Can you feel it? Okay, let's turn now. Whoosh. His mother's eyes nearly popped out of her head. What's happened? We've hacked the nervous system here. Okay, he's got a lot of emotional association around a very traumatic situation. We've gone in with things that are all about pure pleasure. And we've gone with that, and that's how we change the movement. So you can tell I love all of this, the fact that we don't have to be one thing or the other. We don't have to be biomechanists or, you know, brain people. We're human people. It's all everything together. So what it comes down to then is that if we were a kaleidoscope, and we all have all of these colored crystals, people who move well have lots and lots of dial settings on their kaleidoscope. So they've got the same crystals, but they can make so many different patterns from them. And so the question we have is, could all of us work towards having a few more settings in our kaleidoscope? If we have these basic foundations, then we can put them together in all sorts of different ways so that we can create this beautiful picture in our movement. So that's my little introduction to the power and the grace. There we are.
Wonderful. That was really, I love that last story. It was beautiful.
Thank you. It was a wonderful moment.
Yeah, gorgeous story. Thank you. So if you've got any questions, please do put them in the chat or in the Q&A. That would be great. And I'll put up a discount code shortly for Joanne's wonderful book. The slides you had there, were they images from the book, Joanne? Yeah.
I've tried to pick just a variety of things so that people can see what it's all about. I mean, there's lots of pictures of different, you know, techniques that we might use to help somebody to find their way into their body.
Yeah.
As well, kind of practice. It's something to pick up and use practically. Mm. And like I said, it's written in a way where what I want people to see is that there is an art to applying the science. Mm. There is science behind the art of application, but we can explain it all to a 10-year-old if we tell it like a story.
Mm. Wonderful. There's a question here: is it going to be available on Kindle?
I think there is a digital version.
I think Hans can do. Yeah, I think they do.
Yeah, I think I think there is a digital version.
Cool.
I mean, so once I've done the writing thing, I send it all off and the rest of that kind of
forget it, don't you? I know in your work you talk a lot about the impact of various things like aging, pain, cultural and beliefs. And because a lot of us, particularly manual therapists, are working so many with people with so much pain. Well, with pain. That's usually why they come to us. So that has all kinds of ramifications of how they move, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And how they protect themselves. And then how do we encourage them to perhaps sometimes push the boundaries a bit so they don't, you know, get stuck in patterns. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that something you cover in your book?
Probably not directly, but in as much as the same basic seeds are relevant no matter what age somebody is. So things that I would do to make someone's foot start to connect with their positive support response, I would do with a child, I would do it with an elderly person. The technique is the same. Maybe we explain it in different ways. With kids, we talk about having a little goldfish in their arch and when we play with that goldfish. And Maybe we might use that for the elderly person too, depends. But I think it begins with expectation, because I mean, I get 30-year-old people coming and telling me the problem is because they're getting older. Seriously.
Yeah, then you get that all the time. It's just that it's just terrible.
Yeah. And we're kind of surrounded by that, aren't we?
Yeah.
So one of the big things that we will tend to advocate is find the thing that they can do that they didn't realize. So, you know, I often say that I used to think as a young therapist, I was finding a deficit and then I was helping the person to fill that deficit. And actually, in truth, what I've realized is people actually have a lot of what they need, but they just can't get at it for whatever reason that is. So if I have somebody who can't stand on their leg, so for example, I had a patient, he'd had bilateral total hip replacements. He came to me for balance, and sure enough, he couldn't balance on either leg. And actually we just spent the session just playing together with this foot and the tibial rotation actively together. And he got up at the end and he could stand on one leg and then the other. So he was clearly capable of it, but he didn't have access to the components he needed. And then, so he went out with a completely different view of himself as a 77-year-old man to say, hang on a minute, you're still in the game here. Let's just shift the expectations. But the way we do it is to use these very normal underpinning seed movements. Most people can get to some aspect of it, and that can start to change that expectation and start to change that kind of sense of, well, that's not what I was expecting of myself. Mm. So I'm a huge, you know, advocate of not getting caught up on age. Because a lot of the time people have been given exercises rather than things that actually enable them into their movement with greater ease. And there's the distinction between the two approaches.
Mm. Wonderful. There's a question here about whether, because I know you've worked in Sweden before, and just wondered whether there's going to be a Swedish version of your book. Do you know?
I really, really hope so. My publisher is aware. I mean, I've been working and teaching in Sweden prolifically over the last 15 years. So it's there is an awareness there, and I really hope we can manage to have that happen. As I found with my previous book, which is in Swedish, it took a great deal of work to get the translation really, really accurate, to get the sense of the words. So if we can get a Swedish translation, I'll really want to have some of my practitioners over there involved to make sure that you get the closest possible translation that, you know, that we can manage.
Wonderful. And I know, John, a passion of yours is working obviously with kids, but also with musicians and young musicians. And I know you've got some funding to help with an injury prevention program for children, young musicians. Could you just talk a little bit about the common things that you see with musicians? When I was, because I'm a flautist, and when I was at college and stuff, with the Alexander technique was being used a lot and still is being used a lot, and was very helpful. But I developed some certain, but they wouldn't call them injuries, but certainly patterns of standing, which were not very helpful.
Yeah.
What do you kind of see happening a lot with those kids?
Yeah, I think if I work back from kind of college level backwards, we got heavily involved with the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama, because we noticed that we were getting a real proliferation of students coming in with big injuries. And just like, well, they're not going to make it. They're in first year. And the college was just magnificently receptive, as was the Musicians Benevolent Fund, when we presented to them the challenges of these young people when they arrive at college and they get this document that says how many hours of practice they have to do a day. Mm. And of course, there's that whole issue of what is quality practice? Can you actually say this number of hours? Because actually, if the good quality practice was in small, focused chunks, it's probably better for the learning, but also gives the body time for adaptation. So some of these kids were going from a certain level all the way up with no time for tissue adaptation. And then we went and did some work with the Melbourne College of the Arts, and these kids are primary school level. And we just asked for a hands up of the number of kids who actually experienced pain practicing or after practice, about 70% of them put their hand up. And the teachers were a bit surprised. So what we've got is kids who are sent to a specialist music college. So there's a lot of expectation from parents as well as everybody else. They practice hard, they're very disciplined, but they have no sense of themselves. So we implemented simple things, simple fun warm-ups to get them into their body, to get nerves moving through the tissues, to get them integrated in their bodies, top to bottom, left to right, diagonally, basic neural patterning, to get everything activated, to get them to feel like they could really stand on their feet, that they had a base, because one of the big things with our musicians is that they've got this focus here. If they're violinists, they have a left hand and nothing else. You know, looking at the kids, you know, you're looking at them and there's no trunk, there's no pelvis to put it on. So then the peripheral attention, if they're woodwind players, then you see it in this tight embouchure, you know, and the neck problems and the jaw problems that are coming from the, because you have to get your stability from somewhere. And if you don't have all of this part of your body to hold you and support you, then you have to be really tense everywhere else. And the pattern keeps going into adulthood. So many of the string players, again, what have we had to do? We've had to put a base underneath that upper body to allow this to relax. And then that gives much more fluency and dexterity in the periphery. So again, super basic principles that are easy to implement. And with kids, making parents and teachers aware about fatigue. What happens with fatigue? They weren't hydrated. They there's no attention to their food. And because it was all about the number of hours practiced. Mm. So the principles are so simple, but I would say that helping kids to get into their bodies is the primary thing that we would do, and the biggest thing that's missing.
Mm. Wonderful. Do you talk, you've talked about the sort of emotional impact and things of it. Do you talk much about the vagus and vagal tone and heart rate variability in your work much? Does that come into what you're doing?
I obviously mention heart rate variability as an aspect, but we do talk a lot about, you know, Stephen Porges and polyvagal theory and how these behaviors are showing up, you know, in your clinic or in your class, so that we can start to understand how to start shaping that interaction to get to somewhere that's going to be productive on the day. But then also it will shape the approach we choose to take. If you've got someone, for example, who is in a collapsed state, it's very tempting to want to really activate them. But actually, then you can push them further into overwhelm. Mm. So it's about, you know, we've got techniques that actually work with actually getting that sense again of boundary and a bit of activation, but without overwhelm. Mm. You might have your person who's in sympathetic drive, totally different situation. Mm. Or that ventral vagal, you know, response where that person just keeps talking and talking and talking and talking and connecting and connecting and connecting. You can't get them to focus on anything because they're still connecting with you. And when you actually start to realize, okay, this is a response here. It's not just that they're very chatty. This is how they are actually dealing with their emotional state at the moment. So I know what to do here. Mm. So yeah, it is very much about understanding that as a background, and it will choose and shape the flow of how that session is going to go.
Yeah, wonderful. Mm. We've got an Australian lady called Maura Dempsey. She's going to be running a course for our sister platform, Our Birth Journey, about primitive reflexes. And I know we touched on that a little bit earlier. And she was talking last week about how, you know, you get some people who just have to move. They have to move something in their bodies, you know. And I know from what you said before, like the Stephen Porges talks about mobilization without fear, isn't it? So how to engage this more ventral vagus at the same time within movement and engagement.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It sounds like you're using that a lot in your work, like play.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what we want to do is kind of activate people's curiosity circuitry.
Yeah.
And when we can start to do that, we're already starting to shift them. They're starting to become interested, and we have a specific way of questioning people so that we actually keep them investigating things, and they can't ever get anything wrong. There's some really important thing. People come thinking that there's something inherently wrong with them, that the exercises and the way they're doing it is wrong. It's never wrong. It's just one way that the brain is solving the problem, and it's offering this, and you'll say, thank you very much. And we're going to find another way to do this now. So let's investigate this, and we'll ask another question. We keep that whole curiosity aspect rolling, so that they're actually making the discoveries. It's their discovery. And that's what they're going home with.
Mm.
Yeah, I can see that there's some...
a few questions coming in there. Can you see them?
I can. Absolutely. Ivana. Hi, Ivana. Good to see you. Do I talk to my patients much about pain and pain science? Do you know, surprisingly little compared to the fashion at the moment. I'm not saying I don't, but I don't probably go into a huge depth about pain science, or not in the pain science talk. There might be things that drop in as we go through a session, for example, if it's relevant. But it's interesting in terms of the kind of pain science I might have been presenting earlier. Actually, I kind of keep it directed on the positive, more so. Not that it's not positive, and with some people, the knowledge is power. So I think I would say, I'm kind of trying to say things to myself, do I do pain science? It must be there, but I think it's there in story form rather than in, you know, fact form, if that makes any sense. And Kenny, hi Kenny. I often have trouble integrating the visualization component, mainly because I strain to hold the image in my mind, fearing that if I forget it, my movement will immediately regress. How could you offer any more advice on how to better integrate visualization into movement or other techniques? I totally understand, Kenny, about the thinking and the feeling of needing to get it right and get it perfect. Really understand it. And we'll start off with, there's nothing that you can do that is wrong. It's just information. So if I was with you, I'd be finding out, well, okay, so what do you notice about this, for example? I'm not likely just to say, what do you notice? Because that can be a really threatening question if you don't know what I'm after. So I might say, well, when we're doing this particular thing, where do you notice the pressure under your foot? And you might say, I'm not really sure, because when you're in perfectionist mode, you can't sense yourself very well. And I'm going to say, that's fine, actually, Kenny. I tell you what, why don't you put some weight on the opposite side, on the inner side of your foot? And you'll say, okay, I can feel that. So, well, why don't you go back to where you were? Oh, yes, I was on the outside of my foot. Exactly. So is there an option that's somewhere in the middle of those two things where you can feel a bit more foot, and that won't be that difficult for you? I'll say, okay, so we're just going to be aware of that and see what happens if I lift my arm, for example. Do we still have some contact with the foot, or does it go somewhere else? So perhaps it's not visualization that does it for you, but actually just sensing something. Pick anywhere. I don't know what kind of exercises or movements you're doing, but just pick somewhere in the body and ask yourself, okay, this is where I am when I start. Now, when I do this movement, what happens in that part of my body? Does it get longer or shorter? Does it get looser or tighter? Wider or narrower? Just start with just what happens. And the next question you ask is there anything I could do to change that? Knowing that it cannot be wrong, all we're doing is finding another option. So another dial on your kaleidoscope. Okay. So it's the best I can do, not completely knowing what context you're in, but I hope that that's just a little bit helpful for you.
Great. Thank you so much. That was really wonderful. Such beautiful work that you're doing. I really love that. That's great.
It was lovely to have the opportunity to come and share it with you.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like what we're all about on eHealth, really. You know, bringing all these aspects together, not being overly biomechanical. So yeah, fantastic.
No. That's what I loved when you contacted me and I looked on your website and saw the wonderful speakers and topics that you have. I thought this is just lovely that there is a space like this. You know, I think it's very, very necessary. So I'm just very happy to be a part of it.
Wonderful. Thank you. So Joanne's book is available from Handspring. I'll put a link up in a sec when we stop. And there is a discount code, which is springboard421. I'll put that up. That's all lowercase, springboard421. And I'll put that up on the chat as well. And just to say that we've got coming up on our sister site, ourbirthjourney.com. On Monday, we have a course with Maura Dempsey, who's going to be title of her course actually is The Work of Babies is to Move. And it's all about how primitive reflexes form in response to movement, both prenatally and postnatally. So that's, she's wonderful from Australia. I was going to say also from Australia, but of course, Joanne, you've been in Australia for quite a while.
Right? Been a while, yeah. I still have my passport.
And then also later in the month, we have a course with Dean Juhan. And Dean Juhan wrote a wonderful book called Joe's Body. It was kind of like the textbook of all manual therapists for a long time. So very happy to be welcoming him later in the month as well. So thank you, Joanne, very much indeed.
Thank you again.
And we'd love to have you back sometime as well.
I would love to come.
Great.
Let me know.
So I'm going to stop. I'm going to put the thing up in the chat for you, the codes.
Thank you to everybody who's asked questions and come and been so encouraging. I've been looking at the chat and it's just been lovely to have your messages. So thank you for being with us.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Now, do you want me to leave or do you want to...
That's fine. We've still got a few people in. Just while I put the code up here and... what did I say? Springboard. It's a funny code. Springboard. Springboard. 421. Yeah. I'm sure you can give that out as well if you want, you know, for people to get.
Oh, what was it then?
Springboard 421.
Okay. I'm just going to send a message back to Judith here. Springboard 421.
421, 421.